Human beings have a lot of skills and abilities, but regeneration is not one of them. If we lose a finger or other limb, it does not grow back. Other animals can grow back lost parts to varying degrees. In a critter called the acorn worm, the process of regeneration happens to an extreme degree. Seriously, cut an acorn worm in half and you end up with two whole acorn worms over time. Some scientists are riveted by the capability and the possible implications for humans. They are laid out in a recent publication in the journal Developmental Dynamics. This is a team out of the Friday Harbor Laboratories from the University of Washington, where Dr. Billy Swalla is the director and a biology professor at UW. And our guest, Dr. Swalla, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you. I'm happy to be here today.
So give us a little sketch on acorn worms. I mean, where do they live and what do they look like?
So I began working on them. Acorn worms are sort of our, what we would call distant cousins. We're all in a group called deuterostomes. So that's vertebrates, which we are all vertebrates. We have a backbone. And then we have a couple invertebrate chordate relatives, tunicates, sea squirts, which you might know. And then there's the echinoderms and sea stars, sea urchins. Many of you know that sea stars have a great way to regenerate. You can many times cut them in half and they regenerate. But they have this five-fold symmetry. It's hard to see a head or a tail on a sea star or a sea urchin or many of the echinoderms. And so these animals, the acorn worms, are sister groups, so the most related to echinoderms. But they have a body plan like us. They have a head-like region, a neck-like region, a mouth on one side and the other on the other side, and they crawl around they live all over. There's some that live around here. There's also some that live in the tropics, and some of them you can cut right in two as if we cut you right through the waist, and they grow when the back side grows a new head and the front side grows a new tail.
Wow, that is amazing. And is that pretty rare among animals then?
It's very rare, yeah. It's called whole body regeneration, and it's a way that most animals, as you know, reproduce with eggs and sperm, but these animals can also reproduce with what's called asexually, so they can go ahead and split and just be fine and live in a tank. And so I think regeneration is also tied to aging, because you can imagine if these animals never, you know, can replace lost body parts, they don't ever really age either.
Oh, I hadn't even thought about it in those terms. That's pretty fascinating. So do we have any idea what the lifespan of the acorn worm is?
We don't. That was one of the things. I was just at the first international hemichordate meetings, believe it or not. About 30 people were there. When I started working on these in the 1990s, there were probably, you know, three labs in the entire world that worked on them. But now there are quite a few, and we all got together, and we got together I'm the only one. There's only a couple labs doing regeneration, but we got together because one of the other interesting things about these worms is they think that they will help us understand our ancestors, sort of how we evolved. And we know that we share genes with them. We share about 7,000 genes with these animals, and many of those genes are genes involved in embryonic development, genes that if they go mutant cause cancer, and genes for regeneration. So many of the genes we see coming on during regeneration, which was in our recent paper, we share those same genes with humans.
There's the joke, though, about how we share genes with bananas, so we shouldn't take ourselves too seriously. So, I mean, what percentage? I mean, 7,000 genes represents how much of the genome of either humans or acorn worms?
Now, that's really interesting, because I've seen the term that we share genes with bananas. I'm not sure exactly what those are. Bananas are another whole group, being plants. And even though I know that someone said that, I've seen that remark on the internet, I haven't seen the data on that one.
Okay, I quote T-shirts at my peril, I understand.
Oh, okay. I have looked for the data because someone else told me about it, so I looked it up. Well, okay, so humans have about 21,000 genes. Again, we're continuing to annotate the genome, because knowing how many genes we have is only as good as our ability to recognize a gene in the DNA sequence. Hemichordates have about the same amount, and so if we have 7,000, that's about a third of our genome.
Okay, that's a significant amount. So
yeah.
You mentioned them as distant cousins, and so there's a fair number of things we share. And so are some of the genes that the acorn worm uses for regeneration genes that we possess?
Yes.
That's exciting.
In fact, we pulled out a group of about 300 that get turned on, and there's another 500 or so that get shut off. Out of those, I would say we share all of those with humans. So.
Okay, all kinds of interesting implications here. Dr. Billy Swalla is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's a biology professor at the University of Washington, the director of the Friday Harbor Laboratories, and the senior author of this recent paper about the fact that acorn worms can do some amazing things in regeneration. Cut an acorn worm in two, and you get two acorn worms. Join us on the Exchange with questions, comments, observations at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Dr. Swalla, why are they called acorn worms? They're obviously live far from acorns, it sounds like.
Yes, that's true. they have a head region, and we know that the genes involved in the head region, in their head region, they don't have eyes as adults. They have just this proboscis that kind of extends. But we know the same genes are expressed there that we have in our forebrain. Now, our forebrain is where we have complex thinking. That's where humans do. We have a large forebrain. That's where we do complex thinking and things like that. So they have those, that same body part, and they, then they have a mouth region, and then they have an abdominal region. So very similar, to what we have.
So with that nervous system, I mean, is it a central nervous system? I mean, is it?
Oh, well, that's a quite an interesting question. We had at the, International Human Chordate meetings, there were quite a few talks about that. I believe it's a central nervous system. Certainly when we've looked at how it forms, when we're embryos, our nervous system forms by rolling up into a tube. It's a very unusual way of getting a central nervous system called neurulation that happens in all chordates. And these worms also roll up their central nervous system into a tube. People are now doing experiments. The other thing is we've done some experiments on behavior here at Friday Harbor Labs, and these animals have complex behaviors. They live in the mud and sand, so people don't think of them as having complex behaviors. And you have to have them buried in the mud or sand to really see how much they move around and feed. And so we're actually very interested in that as well. We've had some courses with students where they've worked on the research, and we know that hemichordates have a very complex group of neurotransmitters. Those are the things that you use to activate your different neurons and causes behavior.
That's a really interesting thing to think about, though, the way that research works. I mean, we want to get them in a tank and put them in a lab and watch them, and they don't do anything. But if you don't have them in their natural environment where they're moving around, as you point out, in the mud and sand, it's really hard to know what they would be doing.
Yes, I'm embarrassed to say, like I said, I started working on these in the 90s, and I actually didn't think they did that much because I always just saw them in glass jars, and they don't move much. They need the sand to move, the sand and mud. When I came to the University of Washington in 1999 and started coming to Friday Harbor Labs, that was when I buried some of the local ones, and that's when I really realized how active they were and important they were.
That's pretty amazing stuff. I want to get a couple of terms cleared up. Chordates just means we have what, spinal cords?
Yeah, sorry about that. Yes, we are chordates as vertebrates, but we have a vertebrate, and there's a couple other animals, lancelets and tunicates or sea squirts, that also have a dorsal nerve, but they don't have the vertebrate, so they're called invertebrate chordates.
Okay, so I guess I'm still stuck on this whole central nervous system thing. I mean, essentially, are you cutting off parts of acorn worms that you would think they wouldn't be able to function without?
Yeah, and what's interesting about that is what they do is they, when they regenerate the head first, and then they do the neck region, and that's where the central nervous system is, and they roll it back up during regeneration. The timing is a little bit different than they do it during development. So these same genes are probably turned on during embryonic development, but they have a different way of doing it, and we see these stem cells that appear at the very anterior of the worm, and what we're trying to figure out now are these stem cells, these bona fide stem cells that you may have heard of that, you know, kind of hang out in your body and repair wounds and things like that. Or sometimes what happens in these animals is their muscle or their nerves de-differentiate, so they actually go back to being a different state and then crawl out and become something different. And that's really what we're trying to figure out right now.
Not that I want to encourage anybody to take sharp objects to acorn worms, but I mean, I have to wonder how far the experiments got. I mean, did you get to where you had like a 10% of an acorn worm left and was it able to regenerate anything?
That's a great question. And one of the things we found, which is really interesting, is that if you take just the head and neck region themselves, they don't regenerate. And so the regenerative properties are in the abdomen region. And in Planaria and some of the other animals that are known to regenerate, one of the very interesting things that's been found is the stem cells lie in the gut. And we see some stem cells in the gut. Now, your gut has a lot of stem cells because you're constantly sloughing off cells as you eat. It's a rough place in there. There's a lot of enzymes. The food's going through. And so there's lots of gut stem cells, and you need those to survive. And it's very interesting that in some of these animals, those stem cells could replace other parts. That's what we're very interested in because, of course, as humans, we have gut stem cells too. And so if we could figure out how to activate some of the cells we have that are capable of being stem cells, then we could do regeneration. And, of course, that would be amazing for anyone.
It truly would. We're talking about regeneration, acorn worms, and the implications for humans with Dr. Billy Swalla, a biology professor at the University of Washington. She's the director of the Friday Harbor Laboratories and the senior author of a recent report, a paper about what the properties of acorn worms are for regeneration. They're quite pronounced. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, to get into the conversation by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So a little comparison, acorn worms to other animals that do regenerate. How well do they do compared to some others?
So what's interesting is they're one of the best regenerators that we found. Many animals, so I work, I'm at a marine lab, of course, and I work primarily on marine animals. There's two reasons to work on marine animals for research. One is, again, they do have, they share many genes with us, and many of them do regenerate. And the other thing is, of course, you know, we can't do these experiments in humans, and they even seem pretty cruel to do in other animals. But with marine animals, they have lots of eggs and sperm. You can get lots of embryos, so you can do lots of experiments that, you know, wouldn't be ethical to do on vertebrates. And what we would do is try to figure out the rules with these animals, and then once we think we've figured out the rules, then we would go to something like a fish or zebrafish or something like that and try, see if we can get some of these things to work.
You mean the ethical rules or the rules of what happens in the regeneration process?
It's the rules, yeah. You know, you don't want to be cutting animals in half if the things aren't working. Some of these acorn worms actually don't regenerate. So at an early stage in my work here at the University of Washington, I had undergraduates, and they were cutting the worms apart. And some undergraduates got the species that completely regenerated, and some of them got the ones that just died. And, of course, I had to change their project after a little while because it was very frustrating for them.
Oh, I can imagine. I can imagine. And obviously not terribly healthy for the acorn worms
either. Exactly.
So I understand that in the regeneration process, there's some symmetry, too. It's not just that they grow these strange-looking appendages, but they essentially grow back whole.
Yes, that's what's so amazing about regeneration. And, I've watched it over and over and in the lab, and I just find it fascinating. They start to grow, when I first found these in the field, the reason I knew they were regenerating is they had what I called pinheads. So it'd be like if someone chopped you at the waist, and then you had a little tiny head on top of that. They make their mouth very fast, and they are pulling nutrients through so that they can survive while they're regenerating. And then what happens is the head grows to the normal size that it was before, and then it'll start to make the central nervous system, and it makes it the normal size, and that's all new tissue. And once it makes the head and central nervous system, then it starts to repattern. So it goes through what's called cell death. It kills a whole bunch of the cells that were in the old gut, and they're going to repattern it to make a new gut. So they have gill slits. And so they take this back part of their gut and now make a new kind, which is the gill slits. And then they'll just fill in and make the entire worm with exactly the same pattern and exactly the same size that it was before.
That's
pretty remarkable.
It really is. Very sophisticated, for lack of a better term here.
Yes.
Humans do grow a few things back, not fingers, toes, arms, legs, et cetera. But we do have a few things that can go from a little bit to more than a little bit, right?
Yes, and the main one is the liver, which is a very good regeneration. It has very high regeneration qualities. And many times there's reports that, you know, small children, like a baby, could grow back more of a finger than an adult. So it's also something that happens developmentally where there's probably more regeneration happening in younger people. You think about a 5 or 6 year old that breaks their arm, that heals very quickly and easily. Whereas you think of somebody, you know, in their 80s or 90s that breaks their arm, it's a much more serious break then. So again, we believe that this regeneration is also tied to aging.
So do we know the why, what is it that stops humans with again, some of these genes that we share with acorn worms, why we don't have the power?
No, and most people that work on regeneration believe that that's what's going on in vertebrates. One of the things that vertebrates have is a very good immune system. So we have this adaptive immune system that's found only, we know from genomes now, it's found only in vertebrates, and that's the system that you have that makes antibodies. So if you're exposed to some pathogen when you're 5 years old, you'll make antibodies to that, and when you're 25, if you're re-exposed to that same pathogen, those cells will come out very quickly. They're held in your immune system. They'll come out very quickly and take care of that pathogen because you already have antibodies to them. And we think that this very, very good immune system, which has allowed vertebrates to evolve and, you know, fill so many niches that they have on our Earth, has also maybe inhibited their ability to regenerate. It might be that these stem cells are activated, but the immune system is not able to find them, or is, you know, finds them and kills them before they're actually able to regenerate. So that's one of the theories. And at the meetings that we had, there is one person in Alabama who at Auburn University who's working on the immune system of hemichordates, because one of the things we would like to know is what happens with their immune system and how does it help or hinder regeneration.
Billy Swala, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, biology professor at the University of Washington, director of UW's Friday Harbor Laboratories, senior author of a paper about the amazing regeneration capabilities of the acorn worm, which shares about 7,000 genes with humans. You've referenced it a couple times now, the International Meeting on Hemichordates, as being the first of its kind. It sounds like for people in your field, this is a big deal.
Yeah, it was super exciting for me because we had people from Japan, from France, from Canada, from the U.S., all who are working on hemichordates, different species around the world, and interested in the same kind of things. We're really interested in, again, the evolution of vertebrates, or humans, of course, what our ancestors were like. And we're also interested that there were two hemichordate genomes that came out last year. Very interested in how we now get our hands on all these genes, the immune genes, genes for regeneration, genes for development, and try and figure out how these animals are developing. And who knows, they may do things with their immune system that we're not able to do. And again, it'd be very interesting to find those things out.
So I wonder how much research you share or have had conversations with other labs that are involved in human stem cell research, and whether they've inquired about your stuff or had some conversations with you.
Well, that's a great question. At University of Washington, there is a Institute for Stem Cells and Regeneration. I have a couple of very dear friends there, Randy Moon, who is the original director of the Stem Cell Institute. And then I have a couple of friends, Olivia Birmingham McDonough, who works on regeneration in ear. So one of the things that humans don't regenerate is our ear, and there are other vertebrates that do. And then Tom Ray, who's interested in regeneration of the retina, and of course that's really important for the retinal degeneration diseases. And Olivia is actually one of the people on my students committee. So my student Sean Luttrell, who did much of this work, has a PhD committee, and she does have these people. And in fact, Sean's where she'd like to go after her PhD is to do more clinical things and look at stem cells that are closer to being medically relevant than our stuff is right now.
I'm glad you mentioned Sean Luttrell. I noticed her name was all over the
yes.
paper. Yeah.
Yes, she deserves a lot of credit. I should have done that earlier.
Boyd in Wolf Creek sent an email. He asks if this work is proof of the importance of biodiversity. All the critters and plants are inventory for future solutions, genetically and otherwise.
Yes, I think that's a great question, because one of my worries with research is that many times now, of course, much of this work is funded by the National Science Foundation, and people want to show the relevance to humans. And I think that that's very important, but we have to realize that if we share genes with some of these other animals that have capabilities that we don't have, they're really important to study as well, especially if the animals that we're studying don't have these, you know, abilities to regenerate. And one of the things about biodiversity, if you look in a textbook, it'll say there are only 130 species of hemichordates. And one of the things my lab has been doing is trying to figure out how many there are, because what happens is they, like I said, they live in sand or mud, and many times they can be somewhere and someone doesn't even know that they live there. And there's probably thousands of species of them. They've been found in the deep sea now. They've been found almost everywhere that people look. And so we have no idea what the biodiversity of these is or what sort of interesting properties they may have.
All kinds of lessons to be learned here, not just about what the acorn worm can do and what it might possibly indicate for humans, but we've learned a few things today about how scientific research itself goes on in studying things in their environments instead of necessarily in the lab. So you really opened our eyes, Dr. Billy Swalla. Thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, thank you. I love talking about this stuff, and I really appreciate you giving me a call.
Sure. We'll have you back sometime.